You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Infections on the rise, flights on hold, large gatherings postponed or canceled. The impact of the new coronavirus is washing over us all. And when you think about the industries feeling it the most, tourism sits atop that list. And that is certainly true in the Coachella Valley.
High likely they're going to move to end of May, which is 31st and 1st, or they could be in end of October.
Aftab Dada is the general manager at the Hilton Hotel in Palm Springs, and his phone has been ringing like this nonstop all day long.
Well, it's absolutely a huge domino effect. Currently, the pace but the reservation is immeasurable.
Now, this time of year, all kinds of groups usually have conferences in the desert. They're all pulling the plug at once, and in less than a week, three of the region's biggest events have been called off or moved to later in the year. Coachella, Stagecoach, and the BNP Paribas tennis tournament in Indian Wells. That is a big deal for the Hilton here.
Coachella, the Hilton, is the headquarter hotel for the day club parties. So naturally, we were completely at sold-out situation.
Now, hotels are scrambling to fill rooms and keep folks employed. And every other industry down the chain, from short-term rentals to retail, are feeling the effects. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb has been reporting on the impact of the current coronavirus outbreak in the Coachella Valley. He just got back from a trip out to the desert, joins me now live in studio. Benjamin, thanks for being here.
You're welcome, Steve.
Tourism, obviously, is big business for the desert and in many places here in California, especially this time of year, right?
Yeah, definitely. March and April is big business for the desert areas. And I met up with a guy named Scott Weitz from the Greater Palm Springs Convention and Visitors Bureau to explain just how big.
Tourism is the number one economy for the Coachella Valley. It employs over 60,000 people. The economic impact from 2017 was over $7 billion.
So $7 billion, and a big chunk of that tourism money, Steve, comes from these events that have been postponed or canceled, like Coachella.
It sounds like a lot of jobs at stake, too, right? It's the economy.
Yeah, and right now there's a lot of uncertainty about the short-term financial situation of all of those workers.
I don't know about you, but I grew up in the tourism industry, you know, grew up as a busboy, waiter, dishwasher, bellman, you name it, going through school, and you're working multiple jobs, and a lot of it's tip-based, and when the people aren't here and the jobs go away, it's going to be difficult for people to put food on the table and make rent payments or mortgage payments, and a lot of them have families as well, so we're very concerned.
Very concerned, but Benjamin, people visiting out there don't just stay in hotels, right? How's the vacation rental business doing, like Airbnb?
Yeah, you're right. That is really a big business. White told me there's some 6,000 or so short-term rental units in the Greater Palm Springs, Greater Coachella Valley area. So I went to meet up with someone who owns one of those homes.
So this is one of our houses here in La Quinta,
Videl Coronel owns seven different homes in the Coachella Valley, and she rents them out almost exclusively on sites such as Airbnb. And this one?
It's about 10 to 12 people at a time. So, you know, very popular vacation rental so far.
This spot in La Quinta is right up against the base of the Santa Rosa Mountains. And if you've ever been there, driven around Coachella, the Coachella Valley, you're probably familiar with that dry, bouldered look, right?
Yeah.
Beautiful setting, kind of prototypical desert living. And because of that, Coronel says this place is normally booked solid this time of year.
So these reservations during this time, we can rent them up to $500 to $600 a night. Usually, it's about $150 to maybe $200. So there's a big difference there.
It's an enormous markup.
Yeah, it
right?
is.
And, you know, Vidal's going to have to say kind of goodbye to all that cash now.
We have been affected, and all my clients. I mean, my phone was nonstop yesterday for 6 hours, just cancellations after cancellations, and it was insane.
And as we sat down in the house, she kind of half-jokingly told me about her family, her three young children, and that she was talking to her husband that it was a time to maybe start making lunch, no more fancy dinners, right? Really hunkering down to see what's ahead for them.
If all those homes, Benjamin, are not being rented, that affects all the folks who work on those homes, right? In those rental places. Like what about the people who clean those homes?
Yeah, if you start pulling on the thread of the sweater, there's lots of people that are connected to this. And speaking of home cleaning, Coronel started off managing a cleaning service, and she does this still. And she has 16 women who work for her. And with the festivals coming up, she told me she was planning to bring on more employees. But now,
My cleaning business is going to be affected a little bit. I actually was going to hire about 6 employees because we got bombarded with March and April. Since this happened, I have stopped hiring. I am only keeping the staff that I have, which is 16 cleaning staff right now. And we're not going to hire any more. So we're just basically going to see where it goes.
You know, I was also curious about where some other things go, and I wanted to check out some retail businesses. So across the valley in Palm Springs, I walked into a boutique called The Flippery that relies almost exclusively on tourist dollars. Chander Erickson owns the place.
A good majority of my customers are tourists. They come visit from, you know, across the globe, and I would say probably about 80%. I would suspect that my business is going to slow down from this. And also depending on how extreme it goes, if they put in for a quarantine and technically shut down not just the county, the city, but also the state to the whole country, like how they've done with Italy, then that's going to be a little rough. That's going to be tough on our business here.
80% is what she said.
Oh, yeah.
Coachella Music Festival is postponed until October. Can these folks hang on until then, Benjamin? I mean, do they think lots of people will then show up later in the year?
Well, when I spoke with Scott White, they're all kind of selling this October idea. October, things will be better in October. They're really anticipating a big month there. That's also when Modernism Week in Palm Springs takes place.
Oh, yeah.
But for now, Steve, it's all cancellations.
I've been to Coachella. This would have been my 14th time.
That's Rebecca Lieberman, and she's very plugged in, she tells me, into the Coachella faithful community, right? And here's how she and her friends felt when they found out the festival was going to be moving from April to October.
When the official news came out about that, everyone was scrambling to, you know, rebook their house reservations, try to cancel their current reservations. And then just, of course, some people might not be able to make those dates in October. So just the sadness of, you know, not being able to go for this year, and even the uncertainty of if they're going to be back in April 2021. But yeah, a lot of emotions, to say the least.
Now, Lieberman does plan to attend Coachella in the fall. Others, however, of course, are not so lucky. Maybe they have work. Maybe they have other arrangements. Mm. As for Vidal Coronel, who owns those Airbnb properties, she did tell me that most of her renters have expressed interest in coming back in October when the festival is now slated to take place. Of course, we're going to have to wait and see if that does actually happen.
Yeah, it's not a when they come back. It's if they come back.
That's right,
Steve.
That's
some devil in the details, obviously. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb covering the story from the Coachella Valley for us. Benjamin, thank you.
Anytime.
Well, coming up, from the desert to deserted oil derricks no longer in use, but polluting neighborhoods. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. If you live in Los Angeles, you've seen them as you drive through the city. Sometimes they're enclosed. Sometimes they stand out in the open. They go by many different names. Nodding donkey, thirsty bird, rocking horse. Rusting pump jacks crouched over mostly deserted oil wells. But even if those wells are not currently being used, they're in close proximity to many neighborhoods. And they could be exposing residents to serious health risks. So what are they still doing there? And who oversees them now that they're defunct? Joining me now is investigative reporter Mark Olalde, who's been looking into these deserted wells. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having us.
You bet. And Echo Park resident Danny Luna is also with us. He lives near some of those oil derricks, those abandoned ones. Hi, Danny.
Hi. Thank you for giving my community a voice, by the way.
Hey, well, that's what we want to talk about. We are in the voice business. And Mark, I want to start with you. How many wells are we talking about, and where are they located?
Sure. We're talking about 2,500. And that number is wells that are orphaned, meaning they're not plugged and cleaned up. We don't necessarily know who's responsible for them anymore. And they're scattered around the state. About half of them are in Los Angeles, between many of those between Koreatown and Dodger Stadium. So when we're talking about this problem, we're really talking about a dense urban environment.
Why have they been deserted?
One of the main reasons is oil pumping started in Los Angeles in 1892. So in the ensuing century plus, a lot of the oil in that area is gone. And a lot of the owners have just kind of walked away because it's too expensive for them to really want to clean up. And that is happening at the same time that we've had decades and decades of just kind of lax oversight, both from the city as well as from the state.
California is a state with 40 million people. LA County is a county with 10 million people. I suspect a lot of these deserted oil wells are in areas, as I mentioned, in neighborhoods, pretty densely populated neighborhoods. How many folks do we have living in close proximity?
You know, that's a great question that we ran several different ways. We took census tract data from around the state and kind of overlaid that with the wells in question that we identified. And, you know, if you're talking about a very small buffer, only a few hundred feet away from these wells, an area that even city regulators have said is close enough to have obvious kind of air quality issues, we're still talking about several hundred thousand people, I should say, within very close proximity. So this is definitely a large chunk of California's population.
Danny, I want to bring you into the conversation. You're a resident of Echo Park. You actually live near one of these wells. How close are you actually?
Several of them.
Really?
We're actually surrounded by them. Yes. If you look at the map on CalGEM, it's literally on the front yards, backyards of every single household within my neighborhood. So it's pretty dense in our neighborhood, not just one.
So there they are. Have you had any sort of health issues connected to these wells that you can imagine?
Several neighbors have actually, you know, complained about asthma and things related to, you know, breathing. I used to actually help out at a community park, which is no longer there. Now it's a high-rise apartment building that's being built right there. But when this news came out about, you know, the story about the oil wells and me being in it, one of my friends actually commented on it that, you know, he was actually just about to plant a tree in this community park. And that literally by him digging to plant a tree, all the gases and the fumes from there actually came out, knocked him out, and he had to go to the hospital.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, so they're littered all over. None of the residents actually know where they're at because none of them have the proper information, you know, to protect themselves. So that's what I'm saying. They're literally all over everybody's front yards, backyards, and nobody knows where they're at. And the developers don't care, you know, to advise their residents or, you know, take the proper measures to cap them.
Danny, what kind of steps? I mean, you said it's hard to get the information. Have you really tried? I mean, have you gathered people to try and really get this information?
Yes. I mean, in fact, you know, the reason we were involved in this story with the LA Times was because of an oil spill within our neighborhood. But before that even happened, we one small community group that I'm in, which is called, we call ourselves Vista Hermosa Heights Community Group. We were pushing and urging for regulation to happen because we saw these huge developments coming into our neighborhood. And literally, we're going to have residents on top of these oil wells that are not property capped. So as we foresaw that coming, we reached out to CD1, we reached out to CalGEM, and we actually had a meeting with them a month before the oil spill. Foreseeing this happening. So we have been reaching out and we've been reaching out before any incidents have happened in our neighborhood and before, you know, these buildings of high density start being built within our neighborhood. Along with that, and because of that, I've actually, myself and another member within that group, we're now involved in the Echo Park Neighborhood Council. So now we're board members on there too. So it's reluctantly, you know, made me get more involved within my community, but it's something that needs to happen. So yes, we've been reaching out to several groups.
Reluctantly. What has been the response from Council District 1, as you said, or from CalGEM?
CalGEM has actually been pretty helpful. The problem here is the way legislation is written right now. Their hands, I mean, they can inform, but their hands are tied. Like, for example, I just went to a hearing about a developer that's going to be building on Furman Street last week. And when I went to this hearing, the problem is that they already got a CEQA exemption at the beginning of the project. So as soon as a developer gets a CEQA exemption from the city, any concerns from the residents afterwards on every single process after that is ignored. And even though, and actually we had CalGEM and LA County Health actually come to the hearing and both speak about, you know, their concerns about public health and the fact, and this was actually made super clear by CalGEM, and CalGEM does not approve of any building being built on top of or impeding access to any oil well. That is crystal clear. So I don't know what's happening here. I don't know what if money's being heard louder than voices, which usually happens, but something fishy is really going on.
Mark, have you really pushed city and county and state officials about things like this? I mean, what are they telling you?
This part of the story was pretty interesting because, you know, I spoke to State Attorney Mike Fuhrer, for example, and he told me, you know, direct quote, the city hasn't done nearly enough about this issue historically, end quote. I mean, he and others, also at the fire department who I spoke with, you know, understand that the city just has kind of, you know, been asleep at the wheel for decades. And, you know, what I do know is that in some instances, and what brought myself and the rest of my team to Danny's area in the first place was that, you know, we found in CalGEM documents, we found this apartment complex development, you know, just down the street from him, where the developer had taken on the responsibility knowingly of plugging these wells. And that was just kind of the way that it was done, is that the state wasn't empowered enough to force actual oil companies to, you know, to plug these wells. And so they had to get creative. And when they had an opportunity for a developer to do it, they said, well, we guess a developer plugging wells is better than nobody plugging wells, which I guess could be true. But at the same time, you know, it really leaves the question in my mind, and I hope our readers' minds, of, well, why can't the state and the city force the oil industry to do this, not anybody else?
Well, and who knows if they're even following proper protocol, right? I mean, they're not in, developers aren't,
you know,
in the oil business.
Developers are, they do work with CalGEM, to give them their due. They do work with regulators, and so they should be up to speed on what regulations are. And there are companies that they contract with to do the plugging on their behalf, companies that should know what they're doing. So, you know, maybe it's going well, but on the other side, if they knew what they were doing, would this spill in Danny's neighborhood have happened? So a little bit of yes, a little bit of no.
Mark Alalde, an investigative reporter, a story that he reported on the deserted oil wells in and around Southern California. A story, by the way, that was in partnership between the LA Times and the Center for Public Integrity. Mark, thank you for your time.
Of course, great to be here.
Danny Luna, thank you for sharing your story and your Echo Park neighborhood as well. Danny, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Just ahead, in these times of social distancing for people, alligator lizards are still doing their thing, right in front of you, perhaps. How you can capture the moment and advance the cause of nature, next on Greater LA. Back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Alligator mating season is about to hit Southern California. What's that you say? Oh, you didn't realize there were alligators around here. Well, actually, there's a ton of them. Luckily, they're only a few inches long and weigh in at about an ounce. They're southern alligator lizards, and they're about to start getting, oh, let's just say amorous. As I said, it is almost mating season, but these alligator lizards have a strange way of showing affection. And here to tell us more, none other than Lila Higgins, Senior Manager for Community Science at the Natural History Museum of LA County. Lila, welcome back.
Thanks, Steve.
So first things first, these lizards, They give new meaning to the term love bites, which you're going to get into the gory details about this, aren't you?
I am, yes, because it's going to start around about this weekend, or actually after the rain. But every year around March 13th, this is when the alligator lizard mating can be observed. And it's something that our herpetologist, Dr. Greg Pauly, has never seen in his entire life. But through the power of crowdsourcing, people have sent us pictures of alligator lizards. They don't understand what's going on. Are they biting each other? Are they cannibalizing each other? No, they are actually mating.
So mating is biting.
For alligator lizards, yes, the male will bite the female on or behind the head, so like the head or the neck, and embrace her, so to speak. And this can last a few hours or even a couple of days.
You can see how this conversation could get a little uncomfortable, right?
Right. So we don't want to apply human values to biology, to science. And so it's very different what mating strategies animals use versus, we are an animal, but other animals aside from humans use.
All right, Lila, do we know why the males bite the females this way, though? Why is the biting happening?
So we're not exactly sure, but our herpetologist thinks it's mate guarding. And mate guarding is when a male guards over the female to make sure another male doesn't mate with her.
So it's a competition.
Yes, it is. And that is exactly how it happens across, like, the animal kingdom.
I mean, men are pigs, or in this case, men are alligator lizards.
Well, so there's a lot of interesting penis strategy in the animal kingdom.
All right.
And lizards...
Pull the car over, turn the radio down if you have kitties in the car.
So lizards have what's called a hemipenis.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a forked penis, and they have a left side and a right side, and they can use either side, whichever is closest to the female lizard's cloaca, which is the reproductive tract, but also the digestive tract and urinary tract opening. That's what a cloaca is. Reptiles have it. Birds also have one.
So the male bites the female.
Male bites the female.
To keep the female from other males.
And embraces, and sometimes there's tickling involved as well with their short, tiny legs. And then sometimes, in addition to all of this, a second male can come along and a threesome can happen.
Oh, my goodness.
And we have lots of pictures. About 7% of the observations sent in have been lizard threesomes. And it's very confusing to visitors, like, are these all these lizards trying to eat each other? Again, that's why we named one of our blogs. Are they cannibals or are they lovers?
I'm going to ask you a question in all seriousness.
Yes.
When we talk about mating, for human beings, I think that also involves shame, nakedness, things like that, right? When it comes to animals, like animals really don't have any of that. They just do what they do.
Yeah, well, there's social constructs, which the animals don't have in the same way that us humans. And so we have a lot of taboos and what are things that we should and shouldn't do. And animals just, their brains don't work the same way.
I want you to talk to me a little bit about what this lizard is like, because I looked it up on Wikipedia. It says it's, quote, notable for its vicious self-defense and will bite and defecate if handled. I'm not sure this is a guy that I would really want to hang out with.
I feel like that's a bit harsh. Lots of animals bite when they're being self-defensive, like a house cat or a pet dog.
Yeah.
Lots of animals defecate when you pick them up. Snails and slugs do that all the time. I actually really love alligator lizards. I think they're really cool and amazing creatures. They are one of the most common urban lizards found.
Have you witnessed one of these mating rituals, by the way?
I have.
With your own naked eye, I dare say.
I was hiking in Griffith Park, and my friend and I like went off the trail, and I saw this like commotion to the side. And so I looked, and I didn't have time to get my camera out to get a picture.
But you witnessed it.
I witnessed it.
And other people have seen these acts as well.
Yes, we have almost 300 observations sent in by people from Southern California of these southern alligator lizards mating. And this is the first time that this data is coming to light. And we need people to send in their pictures. We accept them in multiple formats. If you're on iNaturalist, the free app, upload it onto iNaturalist. If not, you can email them to us at nature@nhm.org. And you can also tag the image on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter with #natureinLA. Again, we really need these observations for science. Lizard sex, real science.
Leela Higgins, Senior Manager for Community Science at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. As always, a lot of fun. Leela, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Life indeed does go on. That's going to do it for us today. The Bookworm is next on KCRW. We're going to have up-to-the-minute information about the novel strain of coronavirus, the fast-spreading disease of COVID-19. Throughout the day on KCRW, how the markets are responding, I think we've seen. Down 10% for the Dow today. You'll have Marketplace at 2. How governments from local to federal are responding on All Things Considered, starting at 3. Always online at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Of course, listen to the show, subscribe to the podcast as well, kcrw.com. Jenna Cagle produced our program this week. Sonia Geis was our editor. Phil Richards and Ray Guarna mixed and engineered the program. Special thanks to Christine Camito and Amy Ta. Christian Bordahl oversees the operation. I'm Steve Chiatakis, thanking you for your ears and for your time. Take care of yourself. Have a great day.